Hey, I've got two quick announcements before we get started. First, I'd like to thank a brand new Patreon supporter, Scott Strickland. Thank you so much for becoming a monthly donor via Patreon. Really means a ton. Really appreciate it. Second, my bi-monthly book email recommendation list is going to be coming out in the next few days. So if you're not on the list, you should get on there. I normally send out 5 to 7, sometimes 8 if I'm especially focused, good books that I've recently read that I highly recommend. Obviously, I don't use your emails for spam or any of that kind of nonsense. It's just really good books that I've read and that I highly recommend. You can sign up on the website. Just go to mountainprairie.com/reading. Thanks a lot. Hey, this is Ed Robertson, and this is the Mountain and Prairie Podcast, where I introduce you to some of the innovative individuals who are shaping the future of the American West. I meet most of these people through my work in land conservation, or through my hobbies and interests that revolve around spending time up high in the mountains. My guests include ranchers, writers, entrepreneurs, conservationists, athletes, artists, adventurers, pretty much anyone who's doing important work, has an interesting story, and loves the American West. My guest today is Russ Schnitzer. Russ is a Colorado-based conservationist and professional photographer whose love for the landscapes and people of the American West shines through in all aspects of his life. Russ is the Senior Program Officer for Natural Resources at the Gates Family Foundation, one of Colorado's most effective and generous conservation funders. As a photographer, he's worked with some of the biggest names in the fly fishing world, including Patagonia, R.L. Winston Rod Company, Orvis, The Drake Magazine, The Flyfish Journal, and more. And to top it all off, Russ is a former hotshot wildland firefighter and smoke jumper. And as you'd expect, he has some amazing stories from that period of his life. Russ grew up in the Midwest, but he headed to Idaho for college and has never looked back. During and after college, he fought fires throughout the West. And through that challenging, intense, dangerous work, and at least one devastating tragedy, he learned lessons that he still applies to his life today. Russ's entire career is focused on protecting Western landscapes, and prior to the Gates Family Foundation, he worked for such notable organizations as Trout Unlimited and the Nature Conservancy. In his current role with Gates, he's laser-focused on finding community-driven conservation solutions for threatened landscapes. And during this episode, we go into great depths discussing his philosophies around effective conservation in the West. Whether you're interested in the nitty-gritty details of large-scale land conservation or lessons learned from a life of hardcore adventure, there's something in this episode for you. Russ and I were on a tight schedule, but we still managed to cover a lot and left plenty of room for a part two at some point in the future. We discussed the value of private land conservation in the West and the need for community buy-in and ownership for all conservation initiatives. We talk about the importance of agriculture from an ecological and economic standpoint, with some very specific examples from eastern Colorado. Russ also shares some stories from his time as a hotshot and smoke jumper, the lifelong bonds he formed with his teammates, the impact of these intense experiences on his life, and how he pushed through a terrible tragedy early in his firefighting career. There's so much wisdom and valuable information in this episode, so listen closely and check the episode notes for links to everything. Thanks again to Russ for taking the time to chat. Hope you enjoy. The way that I normally start these things is I ask people, when you meet somebody for the first time and they ask you, what do you do? How do you answer that? I'm sure you love that question.
Oh, I do.
I love it.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine like you, I always pause when I get asked that question because I still have to figure it out in my head. You know, primarily, it's becoming easier now for me to say that I work for the Gates Family Foundation and I administer their natural resources program. And through that, I am able to be involved in a lot of different conservation activities in Colorado. And that's an incredible opportunity. Mm-hmm. So that's my primary. You know, but in addition to that, I am a photographer, a little bit of a hack filmmaker, and I'm a dad.
Yep.
You know, those are the things that I do.
And you do them hard, full speed.
Got to go all in. Yeah. And I've been doing photography on a professional basis since about 2007.
Okay.
And I spent, I first picked up a camera in around 2000.
Got it.
But that was in response to a lot of years spent looking at the world as still frames. Mm-hmm. I always loved photos. Always.
Were you an artistic kid?
Yeah. Yeah, like, I was always drawing.
Drawing?
And, yeah. I would have my drawings in competitions and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I really have always been mesmerized by the impact that a still frame can have.
Sure.
And that's just how I always have looked at the world. And it probably goes back to when I was probably 5 years old, mm-hmm. going to my great-grandma's house, and those stacks and stacks of old National Geographic.
I remember that. My grandparents had the same thing.
Stacks.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would spend hours flipping through them.
Did you, at that point, did you think, like, I'd like to do that? I'd like to take these photos? Or
never.
Was it more just the whole adventure?
It was just the adventure.
Yeah.
Those
things
learning.
Are great.
Yeah. And learning about all of these different threads throughout the world, mm-hmm. and you know, whether it was environment or people and culture or art, there's so much out there to learn about, yep. and to appreciate. Like, that's what really fueled the fire for me. You know, I really became, you know, I grew up in a small community.
Minnesota?
In northwestern Minnesota.
Yep.
And that was the world I knew. You know, we didn't get to travel a heck of a lot.
Yep.
We went to, you know, every year we'd maybe get out to Montana or something like that, for a ski trip. But, you know, northwestern Minnesota was the universe. Mm-hmm. But when I got those National Geographics in front of me, and that's what fueled that curiosity, right?
So that laid the groundwork?
That laid the groundwork.
That's cool. And I had a similar experience. I remember I'd go to my grandparents' house and they'd have a stack of those things. And you think about how that was such a jackpot to find one of those,
yeah.
stacks. Whereas now, like everything, there's unlimited info and you can find that stuff. It's in the palm of your hand on the,
yeah.
phone. And I think there's something to having to seek it out and search for it and look forward to it. And I think it makes you appreciate
it. Or just come upon it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just discover it.
Yeah.
Never even know that it existed.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about photography and about conservation. And one of the things I think is so cool about what you're doing is that I think a lot of people think, well, if I want to be a full-time professional photographer, I want to be full-time conservationist, whereas you're able to balance both of them. And I would guess, and correct me if I'm wrong, that they fuel each other. That, you know, being deeply involved in the conservation world opens up opportunities or ideas about photography, and then the photography informs some of your conservation work, and it's kind of this cycle because you've got a long history in conservation from Trout Unlimited to TNC. And so can you talk a little bit about that how they work together?
Yeah. You know, I read a quote one time from a photographer who said, you can either do photography to make a living or you can make a living to do photography.
Yeah.
It's pretty much one or the other.
Uh-huh.
And I've been really fortunate, I think, in being in a professional position to give me access to a lot of different stories.
Yep. Well, you say fortunate, but you earned that. I mean, that wasn't given to you.
Well,
there's a line out the door that people that want to be doing your job. And so
some element of luck involved. So I was passionate about working in conservation. I think it was fueled a lot by my academic background. But you know, I wanted to put my academic investment to good use.
Yeah, and what did you study?
I studied in conservation social sciences.
Oh, cool.
Was undergrad, and then graduate school was environmental studies with an emphasis on rural sociology.
Okay.
And it was always the human side of conservation issues that fascinated me. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of that came from my background growing up in a small community, agricultural community, understanding how natural resources and conservation aren't just they aren't just mechanical things that take place. I mean, they're deeply social, and they're a function of these deeply ingrained cultural roots. And that, as far as how natural resource decisions are made and how they impact communities and how communities themselves can create their own destiny as voices for conservation, like that continues to be my biggest motivation.
Well, that's one thing I want to dive into, and I've got so many questions, but that reminds me, we've talked about this before, between just the two of us, but this, the importance of community and conservation. Because I think if you talk to the average person on the street, when you ask them about conservation, they think it's protecting some big landscape to maybe keep people out, let it be a wildlife refuge, just, you know, keep it, quote, pristine. Whereas a lot of the stuff that you and I are working on is this intersection of the landscape, the community, the heritage, all kind of coming together into this big package. It's extremely complex. And you and I have talked about how it's real easy for these people with conservation ideas to sit around and think up these great ideas. But unless there is hardcore, you know, committed community buy-in to what you're doing, your solutions are nothing.
That's something that has really been reinforced for me recently, in the past 6-8 years. The traditional approach to environmental work has been to, you know, let's study something, let's, you know, do the white paper, let's get the science, and let's make some recommendations for policy changes for, you know, regulatory, administrative, whatever it is. Yeah. All that is in a vacuum. And, you know, I go back to what I learned growing up and my granddad talking to me about farming, mm-hmm. about agriculture. And I clearly remember him saying to me that when he was growing up, and this, you know, he grew up going back through the Great Depression, yep. and, you know, the son of homesteaders in northern Minnesota, and
tough
go of it. But in his life and from his worldview, agriculture was conservation.
Yeah,
there was no separation. Mm-hmm. You had to be conservation minded if you were going to make a living in agriculture. And somewhere along the line, that got co-opted, and conservation became environmentalism and took a lot of people, communities, out of the equation. And now I think what we have the luxury of hindsight, and we can look back and see the things that are successful, the things that are sustainable, are community-led efforts. They come from an expressed need and desire of communities. And we have to put the right pieces in place for them to be able to realize their vision. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is long-lasting conservation.
Yep.
And that is what we're seeing take place in Colorado today. And that's an exciting future to be a part of.
It really is so exciting. And I didn't fully understand all that, you know, when I moved out here and started thinking about conservation. You know, I just my early experience was seeing some real estate developers basically tearing up landscape. And I'm like, well, that should just be put into a conservation easement, never allow anybody out there. And that's not right for a lot of reasons, you know. And so one of the areas that you and I are working on is Southeast Colorado.
Right.
And I think when people think of Colorado, most people who aren't from here, they think about big mountains, you know, snow-capped peaks, big white water rafting, you know, all that kind of stuff. Whereas a lot of this time, a lot of the places we spend our time is just flat, wide open grasslands. And so, but there's also this rich community of longtime residents, longtime ranchers, farmers there. So could you just talk a little bit about southeastern Colorado and why that's important to you and to the Gates Family Foundation?
Southeastern Colorado is, in a lot of ways, a refuge as a region. Mm-hmm. It's a place that's been somewhat insulated from a lot of the other pressures that have affected Colorado.
Yep.
You know, one of the biggest challenges to our work statewide is just population growth. But in southeastern Colorado, population growth is not the issue. Now, there's a bigger issue affecting southeast communities in just staving off the out-migration. You know, we're talking to people in communities like, you know, in Bent or Prowers County, and, you know, they're losing people at almost a double-digit percentage rate each year.
And there are not that many people out there to begin with, you know?
It's a small baseline to begin with. So why it's important to us, one, is it is representative in every fundamental way of what makes Colorado great. Mm-hmm. It's neighbors helping neighbors. It's a traditional way of life that fuels these local economies. And on the ecological side, and not to lose sight of the conservation values, it is a place where large landscapes, we're talking about ranches, 20, 30,000 acres in some cases, big pieces of land, are still intact and managed holistically, such that their functions, their services are largely in place. And that is a huge opportunity.
Yep.
But as we take a step back and look at some of the macro factors, you know, these are ranch lands that are being managed in a lot of cases by, you know, folks that are probably hoping to retire at some point. You know, the average age of a rancher is somewhere in like mid-60s, I think. Yep. And succession is a big issue there. The kids don't see a future for themselves in farming and ranching. And as a result, the threat to some of these big chunks of land that have been managed for some five, sometimes six generations.
Yep.
The threat to those, to keeping those things intact is very real. And without figuring out how to anchor those places and make them viable in an evolving economy and with increasing pressure, you know, that's really the kind of work that the Gates Family Foundation does best.
Yep.
You know, we are very much oriented towards systems level solutions, and that's something that we're going to be continuing to invest in, and why southeastern Colorado is going to continue to be a priority for us. It's of incredible importance for us to figure out how to add the right layers of value on agricultural production in southeastern Colorado so that there is a future for that way of life. And if we do not figure that out and do it in a balanced way, in a way that works for producers and for those communities, it's going to change too.
Yep.
There's just no other way around it. And I'd hate to see for, you know, even places like Las Animas County, I'd hate to see for that go the way of, you know, like you know, the area outside of Fort Collins or Weld County, that is currently one of the hot spots for the loss of agricultural land in this state.
Sure.
Because it's easier to just sell off your water to the municipalities that are growing double-digit rates, and then subdivide your place to with a developer and cash out.
Can cash out big time.
Big time, yeah.
Especially with that water. Well, that's – and, you know, that is – we share this idea that aspect of it all is important for conservation. But I would think even if you were talking to the most stringent environmentalist who doesn't even care about people, there's such a case for the work out there, because keeping these large ranches in place, I mean, the wildlife habitat out there and the ecological diversity, people just don't understand how much ecological diversity is in those grasslands. When you're driving through at 90 miles an hour, it looks like there's nothing out there. But the plants, I mean, they're bighorn sheep out there.
The biggest bighorn sheep herd in the state.
And nobody
is
knows
in
it.
Eastern Colorado.
Yeah.
And nobody knows it.
And so by keeping these, it's important, I think, to emphasize that by keeping these ranches intact, these big chunks of land, it encourages the wildlife, the wildlife to be able to thrive, the migration patterns, all that kind of stuff. You start putting up fences, even if you don't like people being out there, you put up fences and it's going to mess up the wildlife.
Right.
Which is – so it's kind of like no matter where you're coming from, it's so important that people understand how important that chunk of land is.
Well, and two, there's something to be said for the fact that, again, going back to this idea of it being a quote-unquote refuge, it's a landscape that has evolved with grazing. These big 30,000-acre parcels – grazing is a part of why they are what they are.
Yes,
they had the bison herds. The species of grasses and the soil health have all evolved to depend on that grazing regime. So agriculture really is the highest and best use.
That's exactly right. That's a great point.
If we're going to retain that ecological integrity.
Yeah.
So that's really where we've got to get it figured out.
That's exactly right. I think, and for people who are listening that want to read a book to understand the necessity of grazing, there's one by Jim Howell, who's been on the podcast twice, named For the Love of Land. And that was the one that kind of got my head, where I finally understood that. And it, because there's this idea among some environmentalists that livestock is bad. It's bad for the environment. But you have to have that livestock to graze the, unless we're going to eliminate private property rights and bring back bison, we're going to have to use cows for the most part and some bison, but that grass has to be grazed or else it dies. And then you lose a huge plant that sequesters carbon for climate change. And it's just this endless cycle down the toilet.
The whole cycle depends on that grazing regime. And it really in southeastern Colorado is a combination of grazing and fire,
yes,
historically. But if you take cows off the land, if you did that today and just said, we're gonna lock off hundreds of thousands of acres of grasslands and we're not gonna graze them anymore, that land would become a desert. That grass, not only does it anchor the soil and sequester that carbon and trap the very little rainfall that occurs out there, but that's also what hosts all the insects, which the birds depend on, and it disrupts the wildlife patterns that use it. Eastern Colorado, even though, like we just mentioned, people don't really identify that with bighorn sheep, it has not only a healthy population of bighorns, but it has large numbers of elk, incredible numbers of mule deer, not to mention all the other non-game wildlife. And if you break that cycle, where are those things? They're gone.
Sure.
They're going to go elsewhere or they're going to disappear.
in that book that I mentioned, Love of Land, as and if Jim Howell's listening, he needs to give me a cut of all the my promotion of this book. But it there's a great picture in there, and this picture, there are versions of this picture everywhere, but a fence line between a private ranch and a national park, I believe, somewhere in the Southwest. And the national park does not allow grazing. The ranch has been grazed holistically for generations. And you look at the grass, and one side is a desert, and the side that's been grazed by these cattle for generations, the grass is unbelievably healthy.
Yeah.
And it's just a, and so along with the dead grass comes erosion, comes, you know, everything bad. And so that's a point. I talk about it on here all the time, but when that clicked in my head, it was such a revelation that I think it's important for people to understand that. If you want to understand the landscape out here, you have to understand that grazing component.
Yeah. It's something that we've got to be really careful about, I think, as a state, because Colorado is an attractive place for people to move to.
Yep.
There's a reason why we're growing at the rate at which we're growing.
Sure.
It's a great place to live. It's a great place to do business, a great place to recreate. But with all of these different viewpoints coming into the state from elsewhere in the country, elsewhere in the world, we've got to do a better job of allowing people to connect with what it means to live and work in these rural parts of the state. Mm-hmm. And we can't just apply ideas that come from Illinois or Maryland or Florida. They don't work. We have you know, like we said, 5 and 6 generations of people that have come to understand what works in that landscape.
Yep.
And we should really do more to avail ourselves of that bank of information, that wealth of knowledge that exists on the ground in every one of those little towns in southeastern Colorado. That should inform our strategies for whatever it is the future that region holds.
Yep. Back to the community aspect. It just continues to come down to that. So when you think back to your learning process about this whole area and the region and the landscape and the people, are there any books that come to mind that have been important or that you'd recommend people read? And it doesn't necessarily have to be about Southeast Colorado, but just in your career as a conservationist.
You know, it's a... It may seem like a little bit of a cop-out, but I still think the one for me that is most applicable to southeastern Colorado is a Sand County Almanac.
Yep.
You know, that's low-hanging fruit for anybody that's interested in conservation. But what Aldo Leopold explored back in the 30s and 40s is still very much applicable today mm-hmm. in that part of the state for the same reasons. It really speaks to, I think, the fundamental value in utilizing a community-based approach to conservation, one that works for people, that takes working lands into account, that increases the perception of value that those working lands provide.
Yep.
In the context of a larger landscape, there's just nothing that's been done since that will dissuade me from the philosophy that Aldo Leopold espoused in that book.
Well, it's like you hear these cliches about kids. They grow up so fast that they're cliches for a reason, because they're true. And that book is, I mean, everybody says that book who's deeply involved in conservation, because it's all, I mean, it is amazing what he managed to put in a relatively few number of pages.
Yeah.
I need to reread that. I need to read more about him personally, because he just seems like such an interesting guy. This is one thing I want to talk about, and I should have just been recording all of our conversations that we've had over because they've all been so interesting. And one thing I remember we talked about at dinner one time was the importance of aggression. And I don't mean aggression in a bad way, but is kind of leaning into it in the conservation world, because I think a lot of people think of conservation as, hey, it's nonprofit work, it's feel good work, and you know, everybody wins. But I think by applying this mindset that you would take if you were in private equity or if you were in the tech world or if you were in investment banking or whatever, where this is business and there's serious consequences here, and we're not going to be dishonest and we're not going to be cutthroats, but we're going to be aggressive and we're going to lean into it. Can you talk a little bit about your thoughts on that?
Yeah.
Because I learned a lot when we were talking about that.
Yeah, it's something that I feel very strongly about. We have at the foundation, the Gates Family Foundation, there's a motto that goes back to the family member who founded the foundation, throw your hat across the creek. Mm-hmm. And that was something that that they applied as a philosophy in their business. And it's something that we take seriously in how we support the work that we give grants to. You've got to be willing to take some risk. And what we've seen, I think, is as a state, in a lot of ways, there's been paralysis, whether it's in terms of looking anew at how we manage and use water, looking anew at the agricultural economy and how we can prop that up and help it evolve. All of those things require some measure of risk.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to have more folks that are willing to stick their neck out and try new things. May not succeed, but we'll learn.
Yep.
And I think I probably feel strongly about this because of my own learning style, a very much experiential trial and error kind of guy.
Uh-huh.
But that's also, if you talk to any rancher that's been able to stick it out, that's how they do things too.
Yeah.
And I feel like we've got to be able to get more folks comfortable with challenging the rest of the state and challenging individuals. Stick your neck out and try something different. Let's think more about what is it going to take to move the needle on private land protection, on water use and management, on the incredible stewardship needs in this state. All of that is not going to yield results under status quo thinking.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a very new place, I think, as a state with a growing population, a growing economy, and also a state that's part of increasingly more of a regional context, and then by extrapolation, a global context. We have to be able to lead, mm-hmm. rather than just wait for things to happen to us. And I think one of the examples that you and I talked about was specific to water. And it's something that we're wrestling with right now. But, you know, as a state, we're a headwater state.
Yep.
All the rivers flow out of Colorado. And as a result, we have this connection to, like, for the Colorado River, for example, we're connected to six other basin states and the country of Mexico, all with obligations to deliver water, and deliver more water than what the environment provides.
Yep.
And so that has brought us to a point of real crisis in the Colorado River Basin, and the same kind of crisis is affecting the South Platte, the Arkansas, the Rio Grande. If we reach a point in the Colorado River system where the federal government, the Bureau of Reclamation, declares a shortage and comes in to manage the Colorado River, we've lost.
Sure.
So the opportunity is before us right now as a state to dictate the terms by which we manage the Colorado River.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to get serious about that. That's this again, going back to the metaphor of paralysis, we can't keep doing things the way we've been doing them and expect to be in a position where we can dictate the terms of our future. Yep. We've got to be able to take some chances, do things differently, and show as a model for the rest of the basin, as a model for the rest of the country, how these states working independently but with one another can sustainably manage a river system that is in serious decline. So the implications of not doing something.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking.
They're massive. If there's, you know, a shortage declaration and the Bureau of Reclamation coming in and saying how we can use the Colorado River, that's unprecedented.
Yeah.
It's never happened. If it does happen, just think about the impacts on Western Slope communities, on the agricultural economy, on all of those ripple effects of not being able to do things the way that we've been doing them and have it happen like that.
Yeah. And that whole subject is just, it's so complex. And I'm reading a book right now. You may have read it called Where the Water Goes by David Owen.
Oh, yeah.
And it's about the Colorado River. And he basically follows it from the back of Long's Peak all the way to Mexico and talks about all the different issues along the way. And I thought I had a pretty good understanding of different parts of it, but he really it's just a really good overview of some issues. And it's one of these books that points you into different directions you can study more. But, you know, another thing people here on the Front Range don't understand, Denver and Colorado, your average city, Colorado Springs, that how much water we're getting from that Colorado River Basin. And if that water ever gets shut off for one reason or another, I mean, we're going to be in big, big trouble.
The city of Denver, Denver Water, 50% of its water comes from the Colorado River Basin.
I didn't know it was that
big. 50%.
So you think, I mean, if that water for some reason even just got reduced, what would happen?
It would have huge implications.
And when you think about it in those terms, the idea of not being aggressive in this work is absurd because people are being aggressive. You know, ambulance chaser lawyers are being aggressive to get a little payment on the side. And these are very big consequences that have huge impacts on the whole country. And so the idea of not being aggressive in pursuing these solutions, I mean, it's insulting.
It's insulting. Absolutely. I can't think of a better way to characterize it. We have a huge opportunity right now in front of us. And thankfully, we have a pretty good roadmap provided by Colorado's water plan. We have a willingness on the part of a lot of different stakeholders to work together to figure this out. And now we just need to be able to walk the walk,
yeah,
and put this thing into action, put meaningful dollars behind it, and show, again, it's demonstrating in good faith that Colorado has a plan, mm-hmm, to do things differently and make it work. That's a smaller example, you know, going back to the time lived and worked in Wyoming. There was here recently, the last decade, there was the threat of listing the greater sage grouse,
yep,
as an endangered species. And in Wyoming, home to 70% of greater sage grouse habitat in the country, that a specter of listing had huge implications on the agricultural economy in that, mm-hmm, state. The state of Wyoming took that very seriously.
Sure.
They put into action immediately a team to figure out what they could do as a state in partnership with federal agencies like the Natural Resources Conservation Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They put together a plan for how they were going to protect core sage-grouse habitat and do it as a state rather than allow a listing to take place and have the terms dictated for them.
Yeah.
And as a result, there's still a lot in play there. Not saying that the book is written.
Problem solved.
Well, yeah, problem solved. Let's move on to the next. I mean, but they, as a state, have been able to better dictate those terms.
Yeah.
And as a result, they've also been able to demonstrate their commitment to farming and ranching as a way of life in Wyoming, the significance of that to those rural economies. And, you know, there's a little thing called oil and gas up there too, but that has been a significant contribution to that state level strategy. But it's a good example of an opportunity to establish common ground and do something that is in response to an express need of the community.
Sure.
And do it in a way that works for that community. Mm-hmm. It's a smaller example, but
I think that's a great example.
And I see the success, and I see the buy-in, and I see people working together to come up with solutions that work for them.
Yep.
That's the bottom line.
I've got a few articles I remember that I read when all that was in the heat of it all, and I'll link to those on the webpage so people can read about it, because that really is a wonderful example. One more question about conservation. So you've obviously been doing this for a long time, and there are a lot of people. I mean, I know I get emails, I'm sure you do too, from people who want to get into conservation one way or the other. So knowing what you know, and I know you recently were in the process of hiring somebody. So, like, what are you looking for? What do you look for in somebody who wants to work in conservation? Because passion isn't gonna just do it.
No, I mean, there's tons of passion out there.
Yeah,
tons of it. We opened up this position. We hired a new program officer recently at the foundation, and we had over 300 applicants for that position. From all walks of life.
All super smart, all passionate. You know, nobody's no jokers.
People that were far more qualified to do my job than I am. And it really hit home for me, you know, what we're looking for. And in the just to support the way in which we work as a foundation, I'm not saying this is right for everybody, but, you know, we're looking for people that, one, are good at building and nurturing effective relationships. Mm-hmm. This is relationship-based work.
Sure.
At its core, we're talking about helping people do their jobs better and finding the right people to build up as potential leaders within their communities, as spokespeople. All of that hinges on the ability to be a good relationship person. So that's first and foremost. The second one is someone who gets that importance of partnerships. Mm-hmm. That we don't work as a independent entity going out and asserting our agenda throughout the state in different places. We have to be able to bring people together. Yep. And to do that at the community level, understanding that, you know, maybe in the San Luis Valley, it's a unique set of partners. They're going to be able to make something happen. In southeastern Colorado, it's going to be a different set of partners. But having the ability to develop that sense of the landscape, that sense of the community, and keep your finger on that pulse so that when an opportunity comes up, you know who to call. You know which other funders to call. You know which other partners to bring into the conversation so that maybe one concern about, say, it's the threat of buy and dry in El Paso County. Mm-hmm. In one little pocket of El Paso County, But that same threat is going to be applicable more broadly throughout the region and maybe throughout the state. So is there a way we can take that one little challenge and address something bigger, more fundamental? Mm-hmm. That's, you know, it's an art. We're not talking about something that people get trained to do in
sure.
college.
Yeah,
or,
definitely
you
not.
Know, or internships or fellowships. It's just the art of being able to perceive opportunities before they're really crystallized in front of you.
Yep.
And then make that crystallization happen. Mm-hmm. If there was a way to put that into more empirical terms, I'd do it. But, you know, it's just a, that's what we look for as a foundation.
Yeah.
And I think the folks that have mentored me along the line in my conservation career, you know, they've been, I'm grateful for every one of those relationships, but those are the common threads. They've been great at inspiring people to do things, inspiring people to learn. They've been great at allowing people to be entrepreneurial mm-hmm. and explore opportunities that may not be very well fleshed out. But, you know, the other piece of it is I think back on some of those mentors, I think the other common thread is they've been excellent communicators. Mm-hmm. They knew how to succinctly characterize things and get people united around a message that was a common message. That's, you know, that's the, again, it's an art form.
It is.
It's not a formula. It's not something that, you know, you're not going to come out with a McKinsey certificate that says you're good at X, yeah. Y, and Z. You know, you really just gain that through experience.
Sure.
And for me, that's what's worked. And I've seen that work for others that have coached me along the way. I just hope that I can, you know, you know, whomever I'm able to work with in the future, I just hope that we're able to continue to build that methodology, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because that's what continues to earn us the trust of the communities with which we work mm-hmm. and positions us to be able to make a difference.
I think that's so well put, and it's hard to overemphasize that relationship aspect. I mean, on every level. We could keep talking about conservation forever, but there's one thing I have to talk to you about, and we've talked about it before, but your career as a smoke jumper, because that is about as hardcore as it gets.
Well, so let's not get carried away.
No, I mean, yeah, you wouldn't say it. It's damn hardcore, and you know it too. And so talk about that. How did you become a smoke jumper?
I was probably 11, 12 years old, and I maybe read a magazine article or a book. I don't even remember exactly what the genesis was, but it was about wildland firefighting. And it hit me at that formative age and nestled itself in my consciousness. That was all I wanted to be.
Really? I didn't realize that
was,
early?
That was all I wanted to do. I didn't know how to go about it. I didn't even understand, you know, how all I had was this very superficial perspective, and it was this thing that rolled together hard work, adventure, risk.
Yeah,
a lot of things are appealing to a 12-year-old farm kid. So I kind of just – I kept that in my mind. Again, not knowing a pathway. I kept it in my mind. And during high school, I volunteered first for Department of the Interior. There was a Wetlands Management Division office in a town near which I grew up.
Okay.
I volunteered for them, And they had a really ambitious prescribed fire program.
Yep.
And so I just asked a lot of questions. Like, this is incredible. You got folks that are out there setting fires, you know, and seeing that linkage between fire and natural resource management. And big thing for me back then was wildlife habitat. Because I was a hunter and,
sure.
And an angler and, you know, seeing how, these prescribed fire programs were really essential to maintaining this habitat for, in that case, migratory waterfowl. Uh-huh. This is fascinating. So I asked a lot of questions of the guy who was supervising me, so to speak, and told me about his experience in fire. And then I went from there to volunteering for the U.S. Forest Service up in Superior National Forest. And the ranger district, Kuishui Ranger District out of Ely, Minnesota, district ranger by a guy named Jim Hines. Jim was the first real mentor for me.
Really?
Soft-spoken guy, really effective as a district ranger. And at a time when the Forest Service operated a bit differently than it does today, but one of the things that he was most passionate about was wildland firefighting. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, how do you come to that? You're in northeastern Minnesota. You know, there's fire every once in a while, but it's not like Western wildfire.
Sure.
Well, he explained to me, it's like we get on these details and we get on crews and go out west every summer. Superior National Forest has a crew that goes out. And I was like, I want in, man. As soon as I turned 18, I was, get my red card.
Really?
I just wanted to be able to position myself to be able to experience that, even if it was just in Superior National Forest. I wanted to get out there and dig line and throw dirt and cut trees down and see a fire from start to finish.
Well, that's the thing that I think most people who listen to this podcast know the idea of smoke jumper. And I had Robert Kreffel on, who is he's still doing it. And I think most people can get their head around it, but I think it's important, at least for me, to think about what you're actually doing, and it is doing, you're digging holes and you're cutting down trees. It's not like spraying hoses on fires you are doing some of the most intense manual labor. With how much does your pack and all your gear weigh? 50 pounds?
At least.
50 pounds long, you know, all long clothes in the heat of summer in fire, digging, you know, just doing manual labor for what, 12, 15 hours at a time sometimes?
Yeah, sometimes straight through. Sometimes around the clock.
Have you ever heard of this guy, David Goggins? You heard of him?
Yeah.
So Navy SEAL, I just listened to his book on tape, which I highly recommend. Not on tape, that shows how old I am. But he so he's Navy SEAL, Army Ranger, has gotten top three in Badwater Ultra Marathon. So he's done all this stuff. He's a maniac. He decides, I need to do something a little bit harder. So now he's doing wildland firefighting. That's his newest obsession. So, and this is a pretty serious part of this. So you had told me that you started out when you finally got into smoke jumpers, your first season.
Actually, my first season was as a hotshot.
Hotshot. Okay. Got it.
I got on a crew, thanks to, again, that district ranger back on Superior National Forest. He pulled some strings for me.
Nice.
He knew I wanted to get on a Western crew, and, I was lucky enough to get on a crew to get things started. Packed up my stuff and drove west.
Went for it.
And that was 1994, which was a big fire year in the West. Pretty active, and there was ample opportunity to cut your teeth. And as a hotshot, hotshot crew is it's a Type 1 crew that is a 20-person crew, and you are nothing if not a 20-person crew. And you know your whole claim to that world is the ability to dig more line faster than anybody else. That's what you spend your days doing.
Yep.
And you have to almost have a hunger for digging fire line. If you're going to keep doing it,
sure,
you've got to love to dig fire line.
Yeah.
And you know, that's the essence of the work. I mean, like you just described, I mean, it's nothing more glamorous than that. It's a Pulaski in your hand for 12, 14, 16 hours a day. And understanding that that's what you're going to be doing. But the real motivator, the real soul of it is being a part of that crew.
Yep. You read my mind. That's what I was going to ask you about.
It's the camaraderie. It's your family. It's everything. They're your brothers and sisters. And that, for me, was an unexpected thing. I didn't have a military background or any other prior experience in that kind of an atmosphere. But the crew was everything, and I loved it. I loved my crewmates, even though you get into it with a few of them from time to time.
Sure.
You live, work, and breathe with these folks around the clock from the start of the season to the end.
And so I know in your career doing that you experienced some tragedy, some bad things happen, and yet that, and we can talk about it if you want to or not, but you kept going back.
Yeah.
And it's not because you love, I guess you do love digging fire lines, but is it the community? I mean, being a part of that team, is that what drew you back year after year despite the risk,
100%,
the very real risk?
100%. It was the opportunity to be a part of that family.
Mm-hmm.
That first year, 94, we did have some tragedy, and I was a part of that. Our crew was a part of that, and we lost a good chunk of our crew. And for some reason, I wasn't lost in that incident, and I had a chance to reevaluate. Our crew was essentially decommissioned for the season. I had an opportunity to either do something else or and again, the Forest Service was a little bit faster and looser in those days.
Sure.
I was able to get reassigned. So I went to a different crew and kept working. And it was because I think that incident was 18 years old. You're still full of it,
Oh, yeah.
And you don't yet fully know how to process things or respond to surviving that kind of thing. The only thing I knew how to do, and big credit to my upbringing, but it was to work.
Sure.
When in doubt, work harder. Mm-hmm. And I was able to get back on a crew, finish a season, another great crew, a lot of good friends. But I was also able to meet some folks on a couple other incidents that were smoke jumpers. And that really started to fuel for me that desire to move into that line of work. It was kind of like, at least for me, that was the next level. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to push myself to see if I could do it. And there's the crew foreman out of Missoula at the time, a guy named Jerry Zumalt. I pestered him even into the off season. I was like, give me a chance. He's like, no freaking way.
Get out of here, kid.
Yeah, you're too young, but at the same time, we did have a connection, because that same incident in which Prineville Hotshots, we lost a big chunk of our crew, that same thing, Missoula Smoke Jumpers lost some folks too. So we kind of had a connection.
Yeah.
Through that experience. And I think he took pity on me as a result. And he said, sure, you can try out. You know, finally he gave in.
Uh-huh.
Give it a shot. And I think in defiance of all reason, I got taken on by the Grangeville Smoke Jumping crew, and that became my new family. And it's a family to which I still feel connected today, you know, more than 20 years later.
I would think so.
That life was everything I could have imagined. It was more.
Really?
More than I hoped for. It's still, even now, man, decades later, it's still hard for me to not identify as a smoke jumper.
Sure.
And it's hard for me to not be a part of that world. Every summer, man, when late April rolls around, I still get that almost butterflies feeling, you know, it's another season.
Yeah.
There's another season coming up and you have no idea what it's going to hold. Big things, hopefully, big paychecks, lots of overtime.
Yeah.
But it's that, if for whatever reason, that drive for me every spring to get back with my family and to get to work.
Yeah.
And to challenge ourselves to grow as individuals, to grow as a team, to do things better, do things faster, do things bigger. That's what kept me coming back. And it was the hardest thing in the world for me. Still the hardest decision in my life was to step away from that and do something different. You know, we all come to forks in the road. And for me, that was either finishing up my master's thesis or going back for another year. Uh-huh. I think if I would have gone back for another year, I'd probably be one of those old hands now.
Sure.
Probably walking with a little bit more of a limp and having a bad back, but still throwing yourself at it year after year.
So when you think about that experience, both the highs and the lows of it, I guess two questions. One, how were you different? So 18 years old before you'd started, and then when you decided to hang it up, how were you a different person? And then two, what lessons have you learned? Did you learn from that time period that you apply to your personal, professional life today?
I think that as far as it being a transformational experience, it was in that context that I wouldn't have characterized it this way back at that time, but it's how I developed my leadership style. Mm-hmm. It's how I came to understand what were my strengths and weaknesses and how I work as part of a team. When I stepped away from it, it doesn't prepare you well for a conventional life, so to speak.
Does it make you think everything's bullshit?
Yes.
Would think you think everything is bullshit compared to that.
You know, certainly that's a piece of it. I think more pointedly, it's like even today, it's hard for me to appreciate consequences for actions.
Uh-huh.
In the same way that other people do.
Sure.
That really was, it was ingrained in me, you know, the it's a pretty simple existence, right? It's pretty black and white. If you mess up, there are real consequences.
Yeah.
You know, someone's going to get hurt. Someone might get killed. So you don't mess up. You take things very seriously, and do things the right way. You know, when Evan kind of got set loose, out in the other world, it's like, well, you can do pretty much anything you want.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no consequence. There's no real consequences.
No real. I mean, what's the worst that could happen? You get tossed in jail. You know, and none of it really seemed to equate to, at least my mindset. And that was the hardest thing for me to navigate. Still is. It's still something I wrestle with to this day is, you know, we live in a world of, you know, these arbitrary deadlines and, you know, late payment fees and you know, all these things I still have a hard time appreciating those things as valid.
Yeah.
They seem trivial.
Your baseline is so different than most people.
And that's been really difficult for me, but
in some ways it's a gift too, because I would think that, yeah, there's probably little issues that come up here and there, but I would think that it gives you this bullshit filter to where a lot of the little normal trivial crap that seems to get people upset, I would hope would kind of not bother you as much, because you're like, well, this is not that big of a deal.
Well, it is a benefit, I think, for me. I think it. I've tried to channel that into being more efficient, more productive. You know, understanding what are the important things on which to work. But at the same time, it's like I know I've been dinged over the years. You know, working in nonprofit conservation and even now at the foundation, you know, if you're in a staff meeting, for instance, and you're talking about a bunch of, you know, administrative things, I have a hard time paying attention, honestly.
Understandable.
It's like, you know, show me where the real meat is here. Like, what is it that we need to be working on?
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, talking about logistics is not my strong suit anymore. Not when it's about, you know, something like how many beers do we need to provide for people at the next event?
Yeah. You
know, I appreciate that, but I tend to gloss over it.
Well, you're self-aware, and I think that's the key. Is it'd be one thing if you weren't aware of that, but you're keenly aware of that, and you know where your strengths are, and you know where you can work on some things. And I mean, I think most people are not aware of that kind of stuff. And I would think that hardcore life and death experience kind of forces you to. I would think either come out self-aware, or you come out a completely just kind of.
I think
self-absorbed guy. There's probably not much in between.
No, yeah, I think that's really true. It's an interesting observation, man. You know, you self-awareness in that world, and that's not just smoke jumping, but you know, any wildland firefighter. If you do it for any period of time, you choose to come back for that next season, the season after that. You have to be self-aware.
Yeah.
Whether you have that innately or not,
you better learn it.
You got to learn it.
Yeah.
And it is something for which I've been grateful over the years, especially as you get exposed to folks that aren't particularly self-aware. You know, it's not something that you really recognize as a skill set or something like that. Yeah. You know, it's just who you are.
Sure.
But, you know, to have that and hopefully to be able to leverage it for some kind of benefit, you know, that's something I just keep trying to do. Hopefully it makes me you know, better dad and better partner. You know, I do think it bleeds into every other part of my life.
Yeah.
I am keenly aware of what I do not do well. And, you know, it's one of those things that, my wife gives me a hard time about even now is, she's like, well, you only do things that you're good at. I was like, well, yeah. Why would I do things at which I suck? She's my wife she's been a triathlete. She's an amazing person. And, when we were first together, we were probably together 3-4 years. And she was big into triathlons then.
Yeah.
And, she was like, well, and I was a runner and a cyclist.
Sure.
And I've always been pretty active in that way and competitive. And she said, well, why don't you do a triathlon with me? I was like, oh, I don't know. I don't see myself as a swimmer.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I could nail that. I could do the running. I could do the biking. No problem.
Yeah.
She's like, well, just come out and do a couple of training laps with me. And she took me out to this reservoir, and it was a cold, windy son of a bitch day. And the waves are crashing over my head as I'm trying to swim, and I'm flailing out there. Finally, I think I did one lap. I stood up, and I said, I'm not doing no triathlons. I couldn't see a pathway to success for me as a swimmer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I – and, you know, there's two sides to that coin.
Sure.
You know, I do try to continue to challenge myself and learn new things have continued to do that with photography and with filmmaking. But it's because I can perceive a pathway to which I can at least for myself do something that's gratifying.
Sure.
For me.
Sure.
But man, with swimming, forget it. Forget it. It wasn't there.
Well, you're not going to believe this, but we got to go to our meeting, which is crazy. So how do people – we're going to have to do part two because we hardly talked about photography. We didn't talk about family stuff. We got a lot to talk about. And I just like looked down. I was like, holy
shit.
Surprise. So how can people connect with you online, follow you on social media, that kind of thing?
Yeah. You know, first my website, schnitzerphoto.com. .com. It's S-C-H-N-I-T-Z-E-R and the word photo, which reminds me I need to get that thing updated. That's my website. You can email me through that website, or I am a reluctant participant in social media. On Instagram, it's at Schnitzer Photo, I sure hope to be able to connect with folks there.
Well, we're going to do another one of these because we got a lot more to talk about. My list, I think I covered 5% of my list. So. Well, that was awesome, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks for this opportunity, Ed. This is awesome.
Hey, it's Ed again. Thanks so much for listening to the podcast, and thanks for listening to that particular episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Before you go, I've got three quick things. Number one, if you like the podcast, please do me a huge favor. Either pass it along to a friend who may be interested, share it on your social media, and or go to iTunes and give it a 5-star review. All those things would mean a lot to me, and they would really help to spread the word about the podcast. Number two, if you've listened to many of these episodes, you know that I love reading and I love talking about books. Every other month, I send out a quick email with a few books that I've recently read and highly recommend. The subjects are varied, but they're pretty much all nonfiction with an emphasis on history, biographies, adventure narratives, and topics related to the American West. There are no sales pitches for ranches, no spam, no other kind of nonsense, just books. So if you'd like to sign up for the list, head to mountainandprairie.com/reading, or just go to Mountain and Prairie, and there's a massive tab at the top that says Book Recommendations. Click on it. There are a ton of good books that I've read. Some of the old email lists are on there. You can go crazy. There are a lot of books. And finally, if you know anyone I should interview for the podcast, please don't hesitate to reach out and let me know. All my contact info is at mountainandprairie.com, and I'm on all the social media stuff, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, blah, blah, blah. So feel free to reach out. I'd love to have some recommendations and suggestions of interesting people I should meet. All right, that's it. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon.